So, Tony, you first came to Northern Ireland 50 years ago.
50 years ago this month, actually. I just realized it was probably, I can't remember if it was mid-April or towards the end of April, but
incredible.
It was.
Incredible.
I came here, 50 years ago this month, it was the first time.
And the timing's incredible because tomorrow you go to Hillsborough Castle to pick up your MBE.
Right, yep.
What a journey.
Yeah, and actually, on the irony of that, when I arrived here in 1974, it was 2 weeks before the UWC strike. So I was here for the UWC strike in 1974.
Insane. What first brought you over?
Basically, I'll do this as short as I can.
It's okay. It's long form. You can take your time.
Yeah, you can edit. But I was 20 years old, and I was working in a factory because I went to trade school to be a motor mechanic, and I was working in a factory. And me and another guy were 20 years of age, and we've been talking about it for a while. And we just like, why are we here? Why are we doing this? We're only going to get. It's going to take us 7 years to get 2 weeks holiday. So we just decided in end of May to quit, and we started hitchhiking, and you could do that in those days. And then we spent 3 days together. He said, I want to go to Canada. I said, I'm going to go down to Wildwood, New Jersey. So I went to Wildwood, New Jersey, and in those days, I don't think it's as popular now, there were hundreds of students from Queens University going to work at the Jersey Shore in those days. And through an odd, one day I was just walking on a beach. I didn't know anybody there, and I heard somebody called my name. It was a woman I knew from when I went to high school 3 years earlier. And she said, I said, what's going on? She said, well, I'm living in this house. You should come over for dinner. You'd probably really enjoy meeting all these people. So I went over. We had dinner. We went out, of course. And then I eventually – out, literally. And so – and then I ended up moving into the house 3 days later, about – probably 3 days later. And then I ended up getting a job, working there the summer, and got to meet probably over 100 people who were from Belfast.
Crazy.
So I, at the end of the summer, said – well, what are you going to? They're saying goodbye. They said, "Well, I'll see you guys next April." And they're going, "Yeah, right. You're going to come here during the conflict," and everybody says they're going to come, but they never do. So I went home and got a job as a mechanic for 8 months, made enough money, quit in April. And again, I have to look at my old passport to see when the stamp is, but it was around this time, and I came over for the first time, and I was here for 2 months in 1974. And I got home. The strike ended a few days before I was to fly home. It was 2 months. I would have been here. It would have been about this time. So, I came home right like 3 days after the strike ended. And my favorite story is my parents are going nuts because, you can't get any news in. They're seeing the news at home.
Right.
The post is not working. Phones aren't working. And I finally, the phone came on about and I phoned home, and my father answers the phone. We always called him, his nickname was the old man. And I said, "Hey, old man, it's me." And he goes, "Get your ass the hell out of there." And so that was, and I said, "Well, I'm leaving." And I said, "My flight's in 2 or 3 days. I'll be home soon."
Okay. Crazy. So what was it about those people that you met that made you be like, yeah, I'm definitely going to come next year? And then you actually follow through. Like, you literally work for 8 months, you save up to come to this place in a time of conflict, et cetera.
I met so many great, the people were just wonderful. And what I ended up doing that summer was whenever I went out with anybody, I was out with them. And it was never with another group of Americans. So I ended up hanging out with them. There was a local bar in Wildwood that everybody went to after work called the Harbor Bar. And so I just would go, we'd work till like off times till 11 or 12 at night, and then just go off to the bar until they closed. In those days, it closed at 3 in the morning. And then we'd go to parties or something afterwards. And so I just had a great time. I got to know people really well as part of that, including actually one of the interesting, apart from everybody else, Monica McWilliams. I met Monica in 1973. We've stayed friends for life. Since then, I actually, when I was home back here in April last year, or May last year, we had sort of a reunion of about 15 of us who were all together there, and she was part of that. So
wow.
We did. I had such a great time. I got to know the people. I was 20 years of age. I didn't go to university. I didn't really care about careers. I wasn't really fussed about doing anything, going down a path. And so I just thought, well, why not go? And amazing. So I made the decision, and I just saved up my money and booked a ticket and decided to come over.
Crazy. There's a few things there that I love. I love the Freudian slip where you refer to this place as home. And actually, pre-recording, you said something very telling. You said 9:30. And I was like, whoa, this guy is properly gone native.
And the interesting thing is, as soon as I go home, it's back to 9:30.
Oh,
and
wow.
As soon as I hit, for whatever reason, as soon as I hit the ground here, I automatically slip back to 9:30. But as soon as I get off the plane in Pittsburgh, it's 9:30 again.
That's incredible.
Without even thinking. It's just
shift. And then the other thing that I thought was really interesting is you didn't care about university.
Yeah.
You didn't care about the career path. No. And here you are. I've had a long academic career all around Northern Ireland, which I'm sure we'll get into, and really, really exciting. So, Tony, you are, as we were saying before recording, you're what we would refer to as affinity diaspora.
Okay.
So you're people who are connected to Northern Ireland. You didn't grow up here, but I mean, already in the, I don't know, the 5 minutes that we've been rolling, like your love for this place is, it would match people who are, if we pulled your blogs off the street, you would far surpass them. And we love doing this series. So this series is part of our ongoing series with NI Connections.
Yeah.
It's the diaspora department of InvestNI. And we're basically on a mission to find people like you
who
love Northern Ireland. Right. And so I really, really appreciate you making the time for today.
Oh, no problem.
A bit about NI Connections. You can head to their website, which is where you can sign up for their free newsletter. And that's where you can find all sorts of information about how to move to Northern Ireland for the first time, how to set up a business in Northern Ireland. If you have been listening to the show for a while and you're from Northern Ireland, you're like, you know what? The green, green grass of home is starting to look quite shiny and you're interested in moving back home. They have all the information that you could possibly need. NIConnections.com is also where you can find out the 30 plus conversations we have done in this series.
Yeah.
So Tony, you come over for 2 months. Then what happens?
Oh, I went back to the States and worked in Wildwood another summer with a bunch of people from here.
So you just stayed on the Northern Irish train the whole time?
Yeah, and then I went, after the summer was over in 74, I came back to Pittsburgh and got a job as a mechanic again and made enough money. And I came over here again in 75, and I was here for about 3 months. And then I went over to Scotland, and I hitchhiked around Scotland and England. And then took a ferry to Ostend in Belgium. I hitchhiked from Ostend to Istanbul and back, and then up through England and West Scotland, and came back here for about a month in November, and then went home. So I was over here about 7 months. I came back again in 77 for about 5 months.
Oh my! It keeps getting bigger and bigger.
But then I was hitting the point. At that point, I was hitting around 24, 25, and I was actually getting involved in things back home. So I was here, actually, when I came here in 75, I came here on a one-way ticket because my plan was I was going to stay. But what I realized was I was redoing things just to redo things.
Right.
And I remember going through Europe at that point. I couldn't see another cathedral. I couldn't go to another museum. And I loved everybody here, but it really became time in 1977. It was time to go home.
Sure.
But I kept the connection here. I'm guessing, I actually don't know. I have to look at all my passports. I'm really thinking this is probably my 85th time here since 1974.
85th?
At least 85 times.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, since 1974.
Yeah, and on that, it's just, what really dragged you into, like, what really made you want to always come back to Northern Ireland?
Great friends here, and it was just, I ended up playing with a football team here in 1977.
you're unreal.
I trained with Cromick Albion, which was a team from the markets, and I trained and actually played in one match with them. It was a friendly. We played the Welders from East Belfast.
Oh, my word. Big rivalry.
We played them on St. Patrick's Day. It was one of the best days ever. You know, we had a great time, and both teams went to the Errigal Inn afterwards. And,
wow.
And the good part was we had two guys, one on our club and one on their club, who knew the horses. And there was a bookies across the street. And we didn't pay for a pint the rest of the day. Both teams are in the bar having, like, just living off these two guys who were hitting the horses.
Class. Unbelievable.
I just loved here. It was a great, for me, it was just a great experience. I fit in. I felt like I fit in. I wasn't sure how other people thought about me. And I made so many connections over the years. It were deep connections. It wasn't like superficial.
Yeah.
And so, even when I wasn't able to come back on a regular basis, like, because for me, the 80s were extremely lean money wise. And that's when the steel industry in America collapsed. And so it was like a 6-year period I couldn't get back. And then I got over, I think, like it was a couple, like 4 years, it was like in 87 and 91 and 95. And then when I started working with, at the time it was known as the Business Education Initiative, and then it became Study USA, and that was operated through, at the time it was called the Department for Employment and Learning, and that's transitioned to like four different names since then. I think it's just Department for Education now. I think it's
your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah, I think it's the DFE now, but it's gone through other ones. So yeah, it was a training and employment agency. But anyway, you got Jobbox. I just noticed that.
Yeah,
actually,
yeah.
A friend of mine who used to be the manager at Hewitt.
Jerry's been on the show times.
I've known Jerry
we actually did a hospitality series together. I'll link it to you afterwards.
Sorry, that was a tangent.
No, we love Jerry. Jerry's an awesome guy. One of our best.
Hewitt, from hanging out to Hewitt. But where was I? What was you talking about?
Study USA.
I had these gaps of like 4 or 5 years where I couldn't get a whole lot of money together. And the good part in all those years, friends would always, when are you coming over? And they would put me up for the 2 weeks.
Oh, man.
Because I was coming over maybe 1 to 2 weeks at a time. And then in 1996, a friend of mine who actually I met him in the 70s because he was the boyfriend of a friend of mine. And then he got put in charge of this program in 1994 when it first started. And they were having troubles with students going over being totally unprepared for the culture shock and not being able to have a support network. So he rang me one day. He said, do you think you can help us out? We got a couple students are having really trouble. So I started ringing them, and because that was before the email was big time. And so I was doing that, and he says, all right, do you think you could do organize an induction, and we'll bring you over here to do the inductions, and then you would be on a trial basis, and then you would be the contact in America for homesickness, illnesses, problems like that. I said, I can give it a shot. So they brought me over for the first time in June of 97 for that. And then it worked out, and then they brought me back again in 98, and then they put me on full-time with that. So it was volunteer basis, mm-hmm. and I was able to get expenses, but everything else was on a volunteer basis, particularly when I was doing it from in home. In those days, I was doing with a lot of phone calls because there wasn't email and there wasn't Facebook or anything like that, and there was MySpace at the time. And then I was pretty good with computers. I actually set up a bulletin board for them to keep in touch with each other. So that's how it all happened. And what that allowed me to do was start coming over about twice a year. And then finally, I was actually 53 when I finished my PhD. So I then got hired at the university as a full-time lecturer. And then that gave me my summers. And that's when I started doing my research work.
Yes.
Because actually, the weird part, you brought up, my PhD is actually in Soviet history.
Oh, what?
It has absolutely nothing.
You cheated on us, bro? I assumed it would be on.
No, it has nothing to do. I started it long before I started university when I was 32, and I got my master's at 36, and then it took me 15 years, almost started in 91 on my PhD and finished it in 2005.
Wow.
And it was in Soviet history.
Amazing.
Yeah. But in the meantime, I started doing all this other research that I really wanted to do once my PhD was finished.
Yeah. Did the love of history, was that always a part of your life?
Yeah, it was actually a lot. I read a lot when I was young, in my 20s. I didn't read a lot when I was a terrible student in high school. That's why I had no interest in academics. I mean, I literally, my grades wouldn't have gotten me into any kind of, like the university I ended up going to. Once I got on the road, and friends kind of made a point from here, probably my interaction with people from here all those years is what kind of also gave me maybe a little push that maybe one day you might want to go to university. But I read constantly. I read, I was a labor activist back home in the Steelworkers Union. I was reading, classic literature. I mean, when I was hitchhiking, I was reading Dostoevsky while I was hitchhiking, on the road. And I was reading all those classics I could. I was reading political theory. I was reading a ton of history because I was being a labor activist. I wanted to know my labor history. So I was reading a lot. So when I went into university, started when I was 32, I took an exam that you could take in the States it's called a CLEP exam, college level entrance program. And you could take tests in like fields like writing or history. And earn credit towards graduation. And so I actually earned a full semester's worth of credit based on that. But that was based on all the reading and interactions I had with people I got to know over the years who had university educations or who were, you know, self-taught as well as I was at that point.
Amazing. So you're doing all this research, managing all these students. Your home telephone line is just ringing off the hook. You're essentially like a big brother, uncle, dad sort of role.
They always joke that as the American uncle.
The American uncle. What a nickname. And so, like, was there anything that the young men and women from Northern Ireland in particular were struggling with that was like Northern Irish, or was it just a lot of the common problems that like any young person would face?
It's like common problems moving, and basically because the program would just situate them and sometimes in remote areas by themselves, and it's like,
so okay. So this is all over America?
Yeah, all over America.
Oh, wow, it's not just like where you were.
No, it was like you had people in Montana.
So you got
people,
time zones you're dealing with and everything?
Yeah, we had somebody up in Alaska. We had people in Portland, Oregon, and Texas, Alabama, Florida, up in New England, in the Montana, Iowa, Idaho, South Dakota, and North Dakota. So we had them everywhere. But it was adapting. I mean, the one thing I always used to do the inductions, I warned them about the humor. The humor here can just tear your heart out. I said, because I used to joke in the inductions, I go, you know, you folks could actually, you know, reach into somebody's chest, pull their heart out, and then just stand there laughing with the humor, and everybody gets it.
Yeah.
But at the States, sometimes when that satirical humor was, people got offended.
Oh, yeah.
Got offended. And the other thing I had to warn them, because the cursing here is very different than America, and I had to warn them about that going over. But a lot of it was adapting to going into rural areas, sometimes going into fundamentalist schools and they weren't religious, or somebody being one religion being put in a small religious school and another school that was religiously affiliated with like a different religion, because the program was Methodist, Presbyterian, and Catholic colleges. And so it didn't matter. You could end up being from a Catholic background at a Presbyterian school.
Right.
And then there was other things back in those days where just the openness of on campuses of the gay culture in America compared to in the 90s and 2000s the way it was here. Some people were actually genuinely shocked by that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And now it's much more open. It's here than I would say in America, or more accepted here now than we're seeing in America.
But
at
even
this point.
Even like on racial lines, like I remember the first time I saw a black man,
mm-hmm.
I was like, maybe like 9 years old.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it was just so like my little tiny rural Northern Irish existence.
Right.
And we're actually down visiting family in Cork. I remember just being like shocked. Whereas like, you know, you go to the States and at that time, now Northern Ireland has changed dramatically, even in the last 10 years. But you're going to have just like massive diversity across the board.
That wasn't the case in those days. So it was adapting that and also warning them about, you know, they were going to run into Americans who were openly racist in some of this, because of some of the areas they were going in. It might not be the students on campus, but it would be people they meet in the public. Because I remember the first time I did inductions, I emailed all the students who had been in America that year, and because I was organizing it my first time, and what would you experience? And one of the things was the racism. And one guy, I still remember, he was in Boston. He said the thing that shocked him the most was the racism that came from those who considered themselves Irish American in Boston.
Mm.
And he said that was shocking to him. And so that there was things like that, adapting the drink laws in America.
Oh, yeah,
you know, 21 being able to drink, you know. The nature of the classroom was different because they were all in universities or colleges, the classes might not be no more than 12 to 15 people, and you were expected to participate.
And, you know, that's the key line.
That's the key line. And because the American system is constant assessment. So here, most of them were used to like taking their exam at the end.
You can't just drink for 10 months.
Exactly. And then do the final exams. And then you're doing quizzes every week. Your attendance is actually taken. And so
things. You guys run a tight ship. Fair play.
You do run a tight ship.
Fair play.
So it was a lot of that people having to adapt to, but that got incorporated into the inductions.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, look, you may not, I always would give them in the inductions the worst case scenario. And I said, if it doesn't happen to you, that's great, but I want you to be prepared for what you might be facing when you get there.
So awesome. I mean, what an education. I mean, you of all people know how travel in and of itself is a huge education. How did you see, you know, some of these students like transform? Like what's the A to B?
Well, I'll actually use an anecdote. A good friend of mine here, this has got to be about 12 years ago now, and his daughter went on the program, and she was very quiet. And when she came back, what I would always do was get volunteers from the previous year to help out with the inductions. And she volunteered right away. And every time there was a question, she was immediately in on it. And I ran into her father on Fountain Street. I said, "How's so-and-so doing?" He goes, "What the hell did you guys do to her?" And she said, she went over this quiet wee girl, and now she's this, like, we can't get her to stop. But she was transformed in a way her personality really came out.
Wow.
Others, like, saw opportunities, like, where they hadn't thought about, well, maybe this, I'll do this rather than law. One of my favorite stories of one of the transformations, she was on the program in 2011, 2012. She was at Queen's Law. I'm still in touch with her regularly. And she decided after she finished law, you know, there's more to life than this.
Nice.
And so she ended up moving to Canada, started doing zip lining and circus training, you know, the fitness training, you hang cords from. So she started doing that. Well, she moved to Whistler, British Columbia, and she has her own successful business there now.
Unbelievable.
Doing the circus. And it's really doing well. And her partner have opened just started another business. I'm not exactly sure what it's doing, but it's taken off well as well.
I might have to off mic ask you for the name, because
I'll give it to you afterwards.
Really,
yeah,
really,
I'll give it to you.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, it's a big thing. It's a big thing for people at a young age to leave. I shared with you, you know, again, before the mic was on. I was 18, I moved to the States.
Yeah.
And that culture shock, that change of environment, it opens up so many powerful things.
Yeah. And it was actually, there was one, I remember. I just have one more. There was when my wife was still alive, students used to come and stay with us if they were traveling every so often. And we had two young women stay with us one year. And it was a few years before Alice died. And we just had dinner with them. We took them out. We did, you know, we chatted with them about everything. And when my wife died, the one woman sent a card and she said, "We'll never forget you two. You were the first adults who ever treated us like adults."
Wow.
And she said, because you sat and she actually wrote it in a letter. She said, "The two of you sat and talked to us and listened to us." And so, and that was something they hadn't experienced and like here. Mm-hmm. And so that was actually eye-opening for them as well.
Big
so
time.
There was little things, I mean, it was tons of little things, but no, the transformation was huge in terms of almost everybody that came back after their year in America. Some went on to do back, especially down their fields. Others just changed their minds. Others took off and moved other places. Many stayed here and have been very successful in their careers here as well.
Yeah, it's really interesting on that point about being spoken to like an adult. Daniel and I were talking this morning about there is a thing. I'm not sure if this is exclusive to Northern Ireland or if it's just, you know, that kind of like a prophet's not welcome in their hometown sort of thing. Uh-huh. And inside your family dynamic, it can be really, really hard to break out of the role that you've always played.
Yeah.
And so whenever you have the chance to kind of like break from that, whether it's travel or whether it's going to university or whatever, it gives you a chance to kind of like, oh, I've got a little bit of wiggle room here. Do you know what I mean? And that's where someone who's really shy can experiment with something else. You can kind of try on maybe a different personality, a different identity, and it's powerful.
I'd like to bring it up. One of the things I would tell them in the induction, I said, look, you're going to go there. Yeah, here you're everybody you grew up with. You're probably still living at home, even at university. Everybody knows you as so and so who does this. Mm. I said, when you go to America, nobody's going to know you. And so, if you want to do acting, do acting. If you want to take a chance on something you never thought you'd ever do, do it. And a lot of them did it. I mean, a number of people who weren't even involved in stage ended up doing stage work in America in their colleges, taking theater classes, and end up coming back and doing local theater here and doing other things. But yeah, it was a basically, as you made it, you're totally right. Many of them, like I told them in the inductions, this is your opportunity to create who you want to be or be somebody different than here. If you want to stay who you are, fine. But if you want to experiment with something else, you can.
100%.
Hi. So I can also link with this because I think it's been a fresh year since I've left school, since I finished my A-levels. And just from getting in this environment with Matt here, it has been incredibly brilliant because of the experience it's provided me with meeting all these different business people, going to big summits and all that, making connections, going to different countries. Like like 2 weeks ago, I went to Spain by myself for the first time. It was the first time traveling alone to a different country. And it was my first time in Spain too. And as much as it was a hellhole to be able to get there in the first place, at the same time, it was brilliant because I've got the experience now.
Yeah.
And it's the fact that it's something I would definitely encourage whenever you do leave school and all that, is the fact that you should try and get as much experience with travel, with making connections and all that, because it truly is like brilliant.
Right.
And all that. It's really beneficial.
Well, you've had an interesting situation where the world has kind of come to you from your producer desk. It's like the world's coming from. So your next step now is to like,
you go out to do it.
Your next step is to dye your hair red, move to like Boise, Idaho, we'll study USA and just completely reinvent yourself, become an actor or something.
Come back as a punk rocker.
100%. Dan's finishing his apprenticeship with us in a couple of months.
Okay.
And so he's really eager about what's next. So I can visibly hear the cogs in his brain turning.
The wheels are moving.
So Study USA.
Yeah.
It's for people who go to university locally here and then they can go away for a year.
Right. They go away for a year and it's funded partially through the British Council, and then the American colleges waive the tuition and fees for the students.
Epic.
And so they, the students have to pay their visa fees and forget the other thing they have to pay. There's another, I can't remember the name of it now. They have to pay their visa fees, health insurance, and so much, but their flights are paid for. And they get a book allowance, and they don't have to pay the tuition and housing costs at the colleges or universities are at. And it's not easy to get into it. It's a rigorous weaning down of going through the interview process to get on the program. And then once they're on the program, they got to maintain on the American level a 3.0, which is like a B average. You have to maintain a 3.0 in your first semester. If you don't, but you have extenuating circumstances, you can appeal to stay on. But if you don't have them and you get like a 2.7, you're going home.
Wow.
And attempt to get a 3.0 overall in the to graduate from the program, you need a 3.0 overall for the entire year. So it gives them it could be from the higher education institutes here. It's not just Ulster University or Queen's. So the teacher colleges, the art colleges. And they're all like, I don't know if it's Belfast Met still or used to be, Belfast Met students going and regional higher education places. So it's a great opportunity. And many of the students, they're nervous. Many of them are nervous before they go out, but it's like, okay, we did it. Like, we got through it.
Yeah. And do you do it as a gap year, or
it becomes a gap year because nothing they do in America transfers back.
Right.
So it's done between their second year and their final year.
Cool.
And so they do. If they complete the program, they own a certificate. They earn it. They earn a certificate in business studies. I think that's what it is. And then they come back and they finish their final year. And one of the things, like a number, like PricewaterhouseCoopers done it, and I think some other companies have done, like every 3 to 5 years, there's a review of the program. And I remember I still have it at home, and they were finding that those who were moving into their 30s who had done the program were actually leapfrogging people who had not done the program but had finished university a year earlier.
Very interesting.
And they were leapfrogging them in terms of business, in terms of getting promotions or moving up.
Yeah, because when you're completely transforming yourself as a person, so the dividends on that, of course you're going to make up the year.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. Yeah. So the MBA.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Direct quote. Just reading this off the transcript here.
So the funny part is, have you ever seen the movie Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure?
No, never.
It's a 90s stoner comedy.
Cool.
And Bill and Ted are these two stoner metalheads And it gets, they get taken into the future and past, whatever. It's like they go crazy. They bring Plato, Napoleon, and everything is like be excellent. And it's everything is most excellent. And so I was, and when I was reading the award, the first, because it's most excellent member of the British Empire, the first thing that came to my head, other than I was incredibly flattered and honored, was I just thought of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
And so the award is in part for your work as the American Uncle, the study ESA.
Yeah, I think it's primarily for that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Because you also have, you've committed a lot of your American life.
Right, yeah. So
your academic life.
Right. So, yeah, I think, I don't know for sure, so I don't like to say whether it was for the other work I've done in Northern Ireland. I think it was because the actual, the award says for service to Northern Ireland and study USA. So I'm assuming that's part of it as well. But I definitely know it's from the British Council, and I would be honored if it was also for the work I've done from my research and within the Loyalist community as well.
Talk to me about that.
Okay. So
if you didn't do your PhD on it, when the heck did you do it?
Okay. So so you have to buy my book. Okay. So the preface actually, am I okay with the mic? Okay. Yeah. Okay. The preface actually explains it. So I came from a position, I always tell people, even how many times I came here, I came from a position of ignorance. And meaning I automatically assumed unionism and loyalism were the same thing. I automatically assumed it was a monolith. I automatically assumed everybody was sectarian or, you know, that they anti-Catholic, whatever. And when the internet started really taking off in the early 90s, I started being able to get news from here on a regular basis. I started hearing about the secret things that were going on, getting ready to the ceasefires. And I started to hear about people within the Loyalists, from the Loyalist paramilitaries, who were actually talking really good sense about how to end the conflict. And I was like, this doesn't make sense to me. And so the first time that I got connected, it wasn't even when I was doing my research. I was just really interested. I knew, like I said, I've kept in touch with Monica McWilliams for years, and I knew she was involved in a lot of things. And I said, look, I'd really like to see if I could meet like Billy Hutchinson or Gusty Spencer or Davy Irvine. And she gave me Billy's number, and I rang him up when I came. I was over for a wedding in 1995, and then I met with him, ironically, on Good Friday in 1995 at the PUP headquarters on the Shankill. So that began, it was fits and starts because I was doing a PhD, I was working, there were family issues at home, illnesses in the family, and different other things. So it was fits and starts. And then I met Davy in 1997. And then in 2006, once I finally got the PhD done, I was like, now I'm going to start this research. I came over during my spring break and started making connections again with David Irvine and with Billy. And then I was like, they were going to be my gatekeepers into like the discussions with people. And they were both extremely helpful. Unfortunately, Davy died in January of 2007. And so Billy then became my gatekeeper, and being able, once I said, oh, you know, who did you talk to? So it's a Billy, okay, come see me, this, that, and the other thing. So it gave me an opportunity to start having these chats. And then I started talking to other people, other academics who studied, and said, well, they said, what are you looking at? I said, well, I'm looking at, you know, what they were trying to do politically in the 1970s and some of these documents I've heard about. And I was told on a regular basis that you'll never find them. They never had any political thoughts. They never wrote anything down. And then so I started going through the microfiche at the Linenhall Library, and fortunately they had already had the database, was like you could do the keyword search. And I started finding all this material that was there that nobody believed was there.
Wow.
So nobody looked for it because they didn't believe it was there. And I mean, like somebody like Roy Garland had done that kind of work. I don't know if you know, he was a journalist for the Irish News, and he had done that and did a biography of Gusty Spence. And so I started getting all this, and I started talking. And then, so in 2008, 7, 8, 9 is when I was doing all the heavy research. And so I did all this research, and I came over in 2009 and did a lot of interviews. And then that fleshed out a lot of what I was doing. And then over the next 3 years, I spent the summers writing the book. Okay. And it took me, 7 years from the beginning till the time I got published.
Wow.
Because I wasn't a tenured faculty. So I didn't get sabbaticals to write or do research. So it was all on my own time and my own money.
So what is it about that topic that gave you enough fuel in the engine to, on your own time, on your own dime, work on this for 7 years?
Because I was absolutely fascinated by it.
Why?
Because it flew in the face of everything I knew.
There it is.
Okay. I mean, everything I'd been taught, people had told me, and even today I've run into people who just look at me like I got two heads when I talk about it. And, but it was just fascinating because it was, wait a minute, something's here that we don't know about. Mm. And there was something going on below the surface that we don't know about. And I didn't – and when I actually was writing it – and I have to be honest with you. When I was writing it, I was writing it for myself. Mm-hmm. And I had absolutely no idea it would become popular. And by the time it came out, it actually did really well. In fact, Sinn Féin actually reviewed it in Unflow Blah in August of 2013.
Unreal.
Mitchell McLaughlin reviewed it, and he gave it a positive review.
Class.
Okay. So, but what ended up, it's just, again, like, you know, Northern Ireland, it's all weird circumstances. Okay. But yeah, so, but anyway, what happened was in 2009 it was, and there's a program on the Shankill, and it's all over Northern Ireland within the loyalist community that's run by the former UVF people, William Mitchell in particular, called ACT, Action for Community Transformation. And they still do workshops where they get former paramilitaries and go through 14, 15 weeks of work to go from active paramilitarism to active citizenship. And William was doing it one time, and there was an American over with me at the time, one of my students. And she was just going there to observe, and once she was there with me, and they couldn't get over the fact that there was an American girl, and her name was Erin, E-R-I-N, working in with loyalists. And so she started explaining her connection to me. So they said, well, we want to meet this guy. So William arranged for, you know, he said, all right, well, it's a final session, come in. So I did an hour-long talk with them in a round, like, it was only 15 at the room. And at the end of the thing, one of the guys goes, you know, that's brilliant. Would you be willing to do that in front of a larger audience? And I said, yeah, but I'm leaving next week. He said, are you coming back soon? I said, I'm going to be in here in October between these dates. Fine. I mean, I was actually out with him last night having a pint. And at the end of it, he says to me, about 5 minutes later, he comes back. He says, how's October 21st at noon? And I said, sure. And so we kept in touch, and it was initially going to be at the Welders Club. And then it changed it to the Northern Ireland Supporters Club on the Shankill. So I did my first talk to 50 former members of the Red Hand and UVF
on the edge of Sandy Row.
Actually, it's at Woodville, on the edge of Woodville.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It was right off Lanark Way. And, so I was at the Northern Ireland Supporters Club upstairs on a Saturday afternoon. 50 people showed up to hear it. And I was really worried that if I did a really bad presentation, that was me done in terms of getting any support. But I got a really positive response.
Awesome.
And so then I got invited to speak at the up in Carrickfergus. I got invited down to the different groups, the regional groups were inviting me. I spoke at the Somme Heritage Center twice to large groups of men and women at the Ranger Supporters Club in Carrickfergus. I did workshops in North Belfast across from the Shore Road, and by the time the book came out, the buzz was there already. Mm. Within, you know, people knew this was going on. And so without that moment, them saying, we want to meet this guy,
yeah,
the book gets published and I'm the only person who knows about it.
Well, you've gone on tour, basically.
Yeah, tour, yeah. I mean,
before, anytime
I come over. Yeah, anytime I come over, can you come do a talk? Can you do a workshop?
Wow.
So, yeah, so I did those kind of things. And so by the time the book came out, a lot of people already knew about it. And I had we did the launch here in Belfast at the Unemployed Resource Center right next to the John Hewitt.
Wow. This is a massive question, and I appreciate that it's like, you know, you could spend 3 hours on your answer, you could do a PhD on it, okay?
Yeah,
so I kind of apologize.
No problem.
But why do you think like we have a nature to oversimplify things and get rid of nuance?
It's not just you, it's everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's
the royal you.
It's, yeah, I deal with this in class all the time, and because I talk about how narratives are created, mm-hmm. because, and there was a, who was it? A.T.Q. Stewart, who's a great historian from here. And I wish I had the quote with me, but it was great. He said, most historians have to resign themselves to the fact that all their digging and historical references and their historical knowledge that they impart is actually meaningless because people are going to create histories and narratives that make them feel good.
Wow.
And he also talked about, he was talking about Ireland, but he was referring to other countries, and or Irish and Northern Ireland. He said, what we do is we take history and make it as soft and comfortable a blanket as we possibly can.
Bro.
Okay. Yeah. And so, yeah. And I mean, you have to just watch American politics. The same thing happens. But yeah, I mean, it's easier because it, you know, it's history that makes you feel good. And it, you know, you don't want to know about, oh, my family had slaves in America in the 18th century, or
sure.
Why should I have to learn about racism when I'm not a racist, but my generation before me was a racist. So yeah, we want those simple, easy narratives.
Yes, and we want our paramilitaries mm-hmm. to be brutal, heartless, yeah. non-nuanced people.
You're right,
because it's easier. It's a softer blanket for us, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Davey Irvine said it, and then Don Purvis has said it, a number of people reference, is when you look at the people who were involved on all sides, nobody parachuted here over the phrase they use, nobody parachuted in here overnight and all these killers came out of the sky.
Right.
These were people who came from the communities. Now, the question then is, I asked my students, why did they make that decision to do what they did and why did others not? Mm. And I always put it in there, says that because these people were all the same age as you are now. What would you do in their situation? And so I put that my class, they come out, their heads spinning, and I literally tell them, if you come out of this class thinking you understand what you just studied, then you haven't learned anything at all from me. Mm. As because I have them during the semester, they meet with a friend of mine who, Big John McCourt, you may have heard of. He spearheaded the historical abuse inquiry, and from Derry, he speaks to them, and he survived Bloody Sunday. And I have William Mitchell from ACT speaks to them. And then we have other speakers come in. One year, Alan McBride spoke to the class. So they get, they're getting nuance. we don't want, because students come and say, well, what should I believe now? I says, whatever, where's the historical evidence take you?
Yeah.
Okay. And so, it's like anything. We want our, one friend of mine once said, I won't use his name. He said, he was talking about Northern Ireland. He said, we want our history like a Chinese carryout, hot, fast, and to our taste. Okay.
No, I don't want that sweet chili chicken. Yeah, yeah. I want the sweet chili chicken from the second Chinese in that small village that I live.
I want it to be hot, fast, and to my taste.
Wow. Yeah. That's phenomenal. Yeah. Tony, I've really enjoyed this.
Thank you.
This has been a lot of fun. Okay. A lot of fun, man. I'm delighted for you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, getting your award. Like, big, big congrats.
Thanks.
To that as well. And, I mean, Alice, did she travel over with you a lot these years?
Yeah, we got together late in life. We actually went on one date in 1983, and that was when I was really poor, so I never didn't ask her out again because I didn't have any money in those days. And then we actually reconnected in 2007 one time. I just ran into her.
Unreal.
And then the year I was over here doing research, she added me on Facebook. I hadn't talked to her in 2 years. So when I came, we started chatting. And when I went home, we started going out. And then I brought her over here in October 2010 for the first time. And I think she came here with me at least 13 times.
Wow.
And before she died in 2017. And so she actually fell in love with everybody here. And in fact, the three people who are my guests going with me to Hillsborough tomorrow are actually the three women that Alice became the best friends with here from Belfast.
Class.
So it's going, and she was all, and I, you know, it was one, I always joke, and, what, you know, would you have turned it down? I go, she would have haunted me till the day I died. She was a complete royalist even before she came here. She got up for Charles and Diane's wedding before I knew her, and then was a Jubilee in 2012. She's up watching it. When we were here in Belfast in 2012, when the Queen was here, I was up in Lynn Hall Library doing work, and she's going all over Belfast, wherever the Queen's car was going.
Amazing.
And the funny part was, so she was at St. George's Market, and they were, you know, the Queen was touring, and somehow Alice got in with the crowd of people they allowed to go in, and she was, me to you, away from the Queen, she couldn't talk for a day.
Phenomenal.
So for her, this would have been this would have been an amazing event if she was alive. She would be bouncing off walls right
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. I know for a fact she'd be very proud of you, man. Very cool.
Thank you.
And so, land of the plane. When you come to Northern Ireland, what do you like to do? Like, give us a very specific thing that you can only do here that scratches the Northern Irish itch.
See my friends.
Where do you like to go?
Well, the Hewitt was my go-to place for years because I worked with the people from the Unemployed Resource Center. So we were always there. One of the places, my friends I was out to dinner with at Ideal on Saturday night, we would always organize something at Le Trois. It was always a great place. Coffee shops. I used to love the Common Grounds, which was on. I loved going there. I did a lot of my research work at Common Grounds.
Wow.
But when I hit the ground, it's like, okay, like Saturday night, we're going out to dinner. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then today I had breakfast with Billy, and then I'm meeting another friend and his, he just got married, and meeting them over at Cafe Nero on Fountain Street. So for me, it's about getting here, getting on the ground and seeing my friends. It's not about specifically where I'm going.
Sure.
It's about who I'm meeting up with and where I'm going to meet up with them.
Well, that's a beautiful quote to end. For the, maybe a final question for a student that's listening to this, or maybe the parent of a student or the auntie or the uncle, like if you were to make a pitch for Study USA.
I think you folks have already made the pitch.
I think Daniel's done a good job.
Daniel made the pitch for it already. Yeah, I mean, it's life. I mean, as the students say, it's a life-changing experience. Mm. And you don't come back different because actually, I'll do it this way. One of the things I used to tell them in the inductions, when you're getting homesick, you're thinking about all your friends at the Bot or the Egg or wherever you're going at the time. And I said, you're worried about what's going on, what party's going on, who's going to the Bot or Egg. I said, when you come back, I guarantee you, you're going to walk into that pub and they're going to be standing in the exact same spot that they were standing in when you left in August. And I said, it's not just that they're standing in the same spot physically, they're standing in the same spot emotionally and maturity wise, and you've come back, you've been to like 40, some students have gone to all 50 states when they were there.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Oh yeah. They made
absolute weapons.
Yeah. Yeah. They get there as not everybody's done that, but they travel to as many states as they can. They've done, I said, you're going to come back with all these spirit experiences and these people are going to still be standing there. And what I would joke with them, and you can cut this if you need to, I mean, but for time, is I would joke with them. I said, you're going to come back. They're going to go, how was America? And you're going to go, you're going to go 100 miles an hour and they're going to go, right, it's time to buy, it's your round for a pint.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to have the link. They're not going to have the link with that experience with you. And you're going to bond more with the people you were in America with than you were the ones you were home with before. Because, you know, like I said, from even me, when I started traveling in the early 70s, I had a group of people I hung out with from teenage years till after high school. And after I got home, I hung up. It wasn't that I didn't want to be with them anymore. It just didn't work anymore.
Yeah.
And I ended up developing a whole new set of friends, more geared around my experiences than I had done for those years before I had left.
Totally. Tony, man. Very, very, very cool. Thank you so much to NI Connections for sponsoring this episode. Like we said, niconnections.com is where you can sign up for the newsletter, find out all the amazing guides they've put together, discover more conversations with people like Tony in the series. And I think the Study USA, I think, super, super interesting.
Yes.
And so, Tony, in advance, congratulations for the MBE picking up tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
And thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. Thanks, both of you. Thanks.